Okay, so welcome to week 4 of 4 on Jewish migrations, origins of Ashkenazi and Sephardi Judaism. The background noise from the hallway here in the high school should subside in the next couple of minutes. We are first wrapping up the issue of leaders of the communities, the Ashkenazi and Sephardi communities in that early period, 11th century, 12th century. And then we're going to shift to talk about some of the practices of the Ashkenazim and Sephardim that differed in the early going. Or didn't differ in the early going and then differ later, and people think that they differed in the early going. But you'll see. I have a lot of material here. We're not going to get through all of it, but we're going to do the best that we can at any rate. And for those who have not yet signed up for the June 7th class in person at Beth Emeth, I hope you're able to be there. Okay. So we were up to our last of the Ashkenazi founders, and that is Rabbi Yaakov, grandson of Rashi, also known as Rabbeinu Tam. And we're only going to discuss him briefly. There isn't enough time to really discuss him. But you have to at least mention him. Remember that among the Ashkenazim and their founders, we started with Rabbeinu Gershom, right? I made reference to the Italians who came from Italy to Germany, but the first one that we really focused on was Rabbeinu Gershom. That's end of the 10th century, beginning of the 11th century in Germany, the one who makes all of those enactments and decrees that we talked about. Then we shifted to talk about the student of his students, Rashi, Rabbi Shlomo ben Yitzchak, Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki. And that brings us to Rashi's grandson, who we're going to talk about, Rabbeinu Tam. So Rabbeinu Tam, again, his first name is not Tom, his first name is Yaakov, was born in the year approximately 1100 in northern France. I'm probably going to mispronounce the name of the town because I didn't look it up. I usually look up names like this to see. But it's written Ramerupt, R-A-M-E-R-U-P-T. I don't know if that's Ramerupt or some other thing, but it's in northern France. The name Tam, that he's always known
it's,
by.
It's Ramot. You don't pronounce the T and the P.
Really? Huh. Well, then they deserve mispronunciations. You shouldn't spell it that way then. Okay. No one ever calls him Rabbeinu Yaakov. Everyone always calls him Rabbeinu Tam. The word Tam means without defect, without blemish, perfect. And it's given to him because his name is Yaakov, and we have a verse in the Torah describing our ancestor, Yaakov, Jacob, V'Yaakov, Ish Tam, Yoshev Ohalim. In contrast with his brother Esav, who was a hunter, Yaakov is described as Ish Tam, Yoshev Ohalim, who dwells in tents, which the rabbis have understood to mean he is a studious person. So Yaakov is described as Tam, somebody who dwells in tents. Now the word Tam can sometimes mean simple, like in the Haggadah, when you have the four kids and one of them is called the Tam. But here it doesn't mean that he's simple, it means that he's without defect.
Can I say, it's also a Yiddish word. It means fine or refined.
Got it. Yes, I didn't know that. That's interesting. I think you might be referring to Tam, which is actually a different Hebrew word that made it into Yiddish. I wonder if that's what you're referring to. Because once you say has Tam, I feel like that's Tam, not being Tam.
Yeah, it's an adjective.
Yeah, so that probably is referring to Tam, though. Okay. So his parents are, his mother is Yocheved, who is one of those daughters of Rashi we mentioned last time. His father is Rabbi Meir ben Shmuel, and who's a sage in his own right. He learns mainly from his father, Rabbi Meir ben Shmuel, and his brother. His brother is also known as Rabbi Shmuel ben Meir or Rashbam. And he is a giant of biblical commentary and Talmudic commentary in his own right, 15 years older than Rabbeinu Tam. There are stories about Rabbeinu Tam studying with Rashi, but historians doubt that that overlap actually worked, just in terms of when Rashi passed away and Rabbeinu Tam having been born relatively late in the family cycle. He became wealthy in business. Wine, apparently, was his industry. And maybe that contributes to the idea that Rashi was a vintner as well. Also involved in lending money. That was, a big trade for Jews for reasons that we've already discussed. He had run-ins with the government, though, at times because he became successful. He was attacked during the Second Crusade in the year 1146. It was the second day of the holiday of Shavuot. Remember that there were, at that time of year, pogroms before the Crusades, but then the Crusades as well. That's actually the origin of the Yizgor practice in Ashkenazi communities, was from these attacks that took place at that time of year. That led to a prayer called Aparachamim, which led to Yizgor. It's a tangent we're not going to get to right now. But ultimately, he left the town where he had been born, which I'm not going to mispronounce again, and he moved to Troyes, which was where Rashi had been and where Rashi had formed his yeshiva. He passes away in the year 1171. He wrote prolifically. He wrote poetry, interestingly, which is included in the introductions to his responsa. I was going to bring one here, but I had enough material already, and I didn't want to bog us down with reading too much. But some of his responsa begin with poems. But his main writing that he's known for are Talmudic, as well as in Halacha, in Jewish law. He is the backbone of the commentaries known as the Tosfot. Remember that I showed you, when we looked at Rashi, I showed you a page of Talmud that had Rashi's commentary in one margin around the text of the Talmud. The other margin, traditionally in the standard publications of the Talmud, has the Tosfot comments. It's an anthology of comments written not by one writer, but by many writers over a period of, you're talking more than a century. But Rabbeinu Tam is the backbone. The goal of these comments that are in the Tosfot commentaries is very often to harmonize passages in the Talmud, as opposed to Rashi, who's just inserting comments to help you read the text more smoothly, for the most part, just to explain the text. He's like, well, why does it say this over here and why does it say that over there? Let's figure out what's going on, viewing the Talmud as one body that's responsible to itself. So it can't say X in this volume and Y in another volume. That's not okay. If you take a look at source number one, Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik is the son of Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, and he has done a lot of work as a historian, including on the authors of these Tosafot. If I had to pick like the main historians who I keep hearing people quote or I read who talk about the Tosafists, it's Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik and Rabbi Ephraim Kannerfogel. Are the names that come up a lot. There are others, but those names come up a lot. I mean, if you get into the, historically the academics, Orbach and others, there are other names, but in any case. Dr. Soloveitchik writes the following in source number one. The greatness of Rabbeinu Tam did not lie in his discovery of dialectic. Dialectic meaning the idea that you have this idea presented here, you have that idea presented there, and they are in conversation with each other. They are presenting competing ideas, which show the complexity of a particular issue. He says, that is systematically employed in most discussions of the Talmud. Rabbeinu Tam doesn't invent the idea that if you look at this source here and that source there, they present different sides of a complex issue. That's Talmudic, that's old. But rather in the scope and depth of his use of it. Rabbeinu Tam's influence extended over the entire Talmudic corpus. He scarcely treated a topic that he did not revolutionize by dialectic. He was able to offer many hundreds, probably thousands, of legal distinctions that subsequent thinkers found and to this day still find essential for any understanding of Talmudic law. So fecund were his ideas, so productive was his mode of thinking, that this type of analysis has continued to the present day. In brief, Rabbeinu Tam rewrote halachic thought by his revival and use of dialectic, and made this method an indispensable tool of Talmudic study. So what he did was, he looked at laws, he looked at ideas that are found in the Talmud, and he showed you how they could be looked at this way, and how they could be looked at that way, and how the two contribute to the way Jewish law deals with particular situations and new situations. That's what he gets credit for. That and rulings in Jewish law that affect every aspect of Jewish life. Every aspect of Jewish life. He dealt with issues of government at times when communities were very much in flux because of the migrations that were going on. So if you take a look at source number 2 as an example, this is a much later source, Rabbi Moshe Sofer, also known as Chassam Sofer, Chatam Sofer. He's talking about an issue in which you have a community that has a particular standard of conduct in a particular issue, and there are those who are violating it. And the question is, can the community punish those who are violating the community standard? And Rabbi Sofer, writing, as you see, end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century in Pressburg, quotes Rabbeinu Tam to give the answer. He says, the practice in all of our exiles is that we follow the majority for all such matters. If we were to wait for all to agree, for everybody to agree, then no affair would be concluded. The community would be damaged. We can't look for unanimity. That's not okay. For the same reason, even Rabbeinu Tam, who rules that the community cannot take punitive action to protect a community standard unless there was unanimous agreement to the standard at the outset, he rules that way only as far as the letter of the law. He would agree that as a matter of common practice, the majority may force an individual to do as they say. He says, letter of the law, Rabbeinu Tam said, a community is not able to punish dissension unless their rule was accepted unanimously when it started. Rabbi Sofer quotes it and says, well, it depends on whether you're talking letter of the law or something that's beyond the letter of the law. Maybe Rabbeinu, not maybe, he says Rabbeinu Tam would certainly agree that there are maybe other factors which affect the implementation. My point in bringing it is not to discuss community standards and rules and minorities and majorities and majoritarianism. My point is just to show you the Rabbi Sofer writing in the beginning of the 19th century on a communal matter is referring you back to Rabbeinu Tam because his statements on issues like this became dominant. He was also very important in refining Jewish customs. Some customs, he said, were simply wrong. On the other hand, other customs, he said, are Torah. These customs are considered to be like a mitzvah from the Torah. You have to follow them. When he felt it was wrong, he felt it was really wrong. When he felt it was right, he was staunch in defending it. If you take a look at source number 3 as an example, it had to do with how names are recorded in a bill of divorce. And he felt that a practice that developed in a certain place was wrong. It was not what was supposed to be done. And he says to the person who's writing to him, he says, you, the person he's writing to, also wrote that one should not change the custom because of concern for slander regarding earlier practices. You're worried that if you're going to change and do what others are doing, then people are going to say that all of the bills of divorce that were written before now are no good. So he says, minhag, I gave you the Hebrew letters, mem, nun, he, gimel, minhag, which is custom, is gehenom, in reverse. Right? People may have heard this line before. It's Rabbeinu Tam, who is the author. Minhag is gehenom in reverse. When your minhag is backwards, that's where it leads. For fools may have done thus, but sages did not do thus. He says, the practice that you are referring to, that you call the minhag, was practiced by fools. You should not follow it and say, well, I don't want to change it now, it's the minhag. He says, that's not a minhag. That's not a valid minhag. On the other hand, in source number 4, somebody challenges the practice of saying a blessing when lighting Shabbos candles. And his response is, in number 4, our customs are Torah. Our customs in, quote, Babylon being the term for outside of Israel, are in accord with the sages of the land of Israel, who are the essence regarding ruling in law. Therefore, one should rely on our Gaonim and the Rabbanan Savoroi. He's borrowing terms for earlier sages. Gaonim and the Rabbanan Savoroi were earlier generations of leaders. And he says, our rabbis are like that. When we say, this is what you should do, this is what you should do. So some customs he condemned and said, absolutely not. And some customs he said, yes, of course, this is what you do. An example of an issue where the rulings that he gave were important socially in his day and remain important today is seen in source number 5. This is a quote from Rabbeinu Tam, brought by Rabbi Moshe Isserles in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law, regarding a man who was refusing to give a bill of divorce. So he wrote, still, they may, even though we have concerns about coercion, because coercion could disqualify the get, he says they may decree upon all Israel not to help him in any way or to interact with him, which I suspect is commercially, is what he's talking about. The language sounds like it's commercial interaction. So he sets the stage for the ostracism, which is used to this day for some man who is refusing to give a bill of divorce to his wife. He wrote on liturgy, the texts of the blessings of the Amidah. He endorsed the use of piyutim, religious poetry, being added to the davening. And interestingly, he's well known as an authority among both Ashkenazim and Sephardim. In the year 1160, I realize I'm monologuing a lot because there's just so much to cram into this session, but I'm going to pause for questions soon. In the year 1160, he brought together 250 rabbis with a convention in Troyes, where he lived, where the family yeshiva was, in which he created enactments for French communities. In the year 1196, the German communities accepted those enactments. They were called in Hebrew Takanot Shum. I should have put it on the list. Takanot Shum. The word Takanot means what? What are Takanot?
Corrections, edicts.
Right, edicts, enactments, decrees, right? Enactments, really. Rules that were created for Shum. Shum is an acronym for the three main communities in Jewish Germany at the time. Speyer, right? Vermeisa, Magenza. Or, to take it out of the Hebrew versions of it, or Yiddish versions of it, Speyer, Worms, and Mainz. So these were the enactments of Shum. The German communities, the German Jewish communities, accepted what Rabbeinu Tam had done in 1160, they endorsed that in 1196. That's in terms of the Ashkenazi communities. But in the Sephardic communities, they also were strong in their respect for him. We've quoted before Rabbi Avram Ibn Daud in his Sefer HaKabbalah. He talks about him. Students came to him from as far away as Russia. Someone asked about Jews being in Russia at this point. There were already some Jews in Russia. He was very, very strong in his responses to those who disagreed with him. He wrote some very sharply worded responsa against those who he felt were doing things that were wrong. And he was really a giant in forming and leading the Ashkenazi community of his day. Clear? Somewhat, I hope. Questions and comments about Rabbeinu Tam? I realize I rushed, but hopefully we got something. Okay. So, one last note before we get to the differences in practice. Interactions between the Ashkenazim and the Sephardim in the 11th and 12th centuries. And this is largely based on the work of Zimmels, who I quoted last week, and I'm going to quote again a little bit later this morning. We've said that one of the reasons the communities develop separate identities is the decentralization of the communities. You're no longer sending your questions back to Babylon or to a central yeshiva in Israel. And you don't have that much communication. But there was some communication going on, certainly between scholars in the two different communities. First of all, we know there were Ashkenazim who went to Spain. An example of that is seen in source number 6. Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi, who we mentioned as one of the founders of Sephardic Judaism, right? He grew up in Algeria, moved to Morocco until he had to flee Morocco because of persecution, and he went to Spain, to Lucena, where he lived out his last, I think, 20, 25 years or so of his life and was the leader there. So in a responsum in source number 6, he tells of the following story that happened. Reuven lived in eastern France with his children, far from Spain, right? Remember we talked about last time how you've got the German community on the one side and the Spanish community on the other side, and France is kind of split in the middle. The part of France that's closer to Germany, the eastern part, is more Ashkenaz, whereas the western part that's closer, or western or southern part that's closer to Spain, is more Sephardic. So this fellow Reuven is Ashkenazi. He lived in eastern France with his children, far from Spain, for many days. He left his wife and children where they were and was sought after in Spain to travel among the communities. This fellow went as a lecturer in communities in Spain. He's supporting his family as an itinerant teacher. He passed through one land and he taught publicly. And when five of the leading community members saw him, they persuaded him to bring his wife and children to that land and to dwell among them. They wanted to hire him, relocate to our land, and we want you to teach here in Spain instead. And it's a responsum because what ended up happening was they brought him there with certain promises, and then the promises fell through. And now the question is, who's on the hook? Because he already moved to Spain. But the point, the reason why I mention it, is simply to show you, you have some degree of travel. That's the point. You also had Sephardim who went to Ashkenaz. Rabbi Avram ibn Ezra, we didn't really talk about him at all. Rabbi Avram ibn Ezra is basically a resident of 12th century Spain, best known for his commentaries on biblical texts, although he wrote on other things as well. But he spent years in France and England. So it's not like Jews are living in Ashkenaz and Jews are living in Sephard and no one is communicating. It's not so. And we know that Ashkenazim were familiar with Sephardic liturgy. Take a look, please, on your sheet at source number 7. The Machzor Vitri, I mentioned this last week, was compiled by the students of Rashi. And among other things, it records liturgy and practices that relate to liturgy from Rashi. So here you find in the very beginning of the Machzor Vitri, in source number 7, the practice of all Israel in Sfarad, which is Spain, is thus, for the leader to fulfill the obligation for those who are not expert. It's talking about the blessings that are recited in the morning. So the leader of the morning services recites it out loud and everybody answers Amen. The leader begins, recites the blessing on hand washing and all of the order of blessings. So what he's telling you here in this Ashkenazi work, Machzor Vitri, here's the Spanish custom. And you find that elsewhere in Machzor Vitri as well. This isn't the only case, it's just the first one. In another example of their familiarity with Sephardi practice, I brought you Rashbam, who was Rabbi Tam's older brother, we said, in source number 8. I think in the interest of time, I'm not going to explain his comment because it's interesting, but it's a fine grammatical point. My main point is what I brought at the end of Rashbam's comment, in which Rashbam is trying to explain a Hebrew word, and he says, so I have found it, this word, in all of the texts in Spain, even though Rashbam is solidly Ashkenaz. He's northern France. Nonetheless, he's quoting Sephardi texts. So there is some back and forth. And then once you get into the 13th century, there's a lot more close communal contact. But the communities were separate enough that their unique identities had begun. Clear? Okay. So let's switch gears.